Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is Cecilia Alderondo.
And Cecilia, so you made a short film about the Momentive strike in upstate New York. For people who are listening or reading this who don't know, can you tell us a little bit about that strike?
Sure. So the Momentive strike actually began a week before the election of Donald Trump and lasted for a little over 100 days. Basically there are over 700 workers who were part of the union who walked off the job, in part because Momentive had for several years been sort of ramping up its efforts to roll back all kinds of things for unionized workers. I mean, there's a backstory here, which I won't go into too much detail on, but suffice to say that Momentive used to be owned by GE. And then it's, after it was sold to Momentive, or became Momentive, it's gone through a series of changes and is currently owned by a private equity firm that, that basically what it means is it's over the years there's been a real distancing of management from the workers. And they have really tried over the past few years to try and roll back salaries, roll back vacation, roll back basically everything that the workers have and erode job security in general. So this is part of a kind of longer fight. Essentially they walked off the job. All they wanted was to keep what they had, really, currently. They just didn't want any takeaways. So they went on strike. And I'm actually based in upstate New York. I live not very far away from Momentive. And so I would drive past the picket line and see these people, you know, out there 24/7. And in my sort of former life, I was a labor organizer for the United Auto Workers and my partners in the labor movement, et cetera. So I basically, after the election of Donald Trump, felt kind of compelled to make something. I was just wanting to do something to respond to the new sort of political reality. And I just decided to go down to the picket line and start talking to people because it just seemed like a good use of my time. And I wanted to know what was going on in my community. So in many ways, it's a local story that ties to a lot of national issues.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit more about the process of making the film. There are some decisions, the way you sort of shot it with just these voices overlaying scenes on the picket line, I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I really think of the film as a kind of day in the life portrait. And to me, when I say day in the life, I mean day and night in the life. And that's because I was just really kind of compelled. Like I said, I would drive past this picket line, and this was, you know, in the dead of winter. You know, the strike began in November and wasn't resolved until, I think, February. And so while people were, people were out there literally 24 hours a day in the freezing cold, standing around these burning barrels. It felt important to me. I was really interested in kind of conveying to the viewer what it would be like to spend, you know, to spend a day and a night with these workers. I was trying to sort of capture the experience of that because, to me, one of the things that I think we don't talk often enough about is what, not just what a union is as a sort of conceptual idea, but like what does it mean for, what is the experience for people to actually come together and spend this kind of amount of time with one another collectively fighting, you know? So it's really trying to capture the texture, you know, the meals people are eating together, the experience of warming their hands in front of the fire, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, we just, you know, part of it was also just sort of practical. Like, we really wanted to shoot the film relatively quickly so that it could be released relatively quickly. And so you know, we just thought it was a good idea to do this kind of really pared down, let's just be with the workers in their space and, you know, in the striking space and stay there.
The Momentum Strike, this town where this is, the area was one of the places that swung several points, I think, from Obama to Trump, you know, over that four-year period. And so a lot of the workers that you talked to voted for Trump. Were you surprised to hear that? Were you kind of expecting it from the way that we'd already been talking about the, you know, white working class during the election?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think in this, yes and no. In the same way that I think collectively we were sort of shocked, nobody was expecting Trump to actually win. But it didn't take that much consideration to try and to actually understand that people had swung. Let me put it this way. I did not expect unionized workers to vote for Trump. That was something that sort of surprised me. And then when I thought a little bit harder about it, it actually wasn't that surprising. And so what I mean by that is, you know, just thinking about this area where I live in upstate New York, you know, upstate New York in general is a place that, you know, for many, many years was, you know, the industrialized heart of the state. And there are many towns, many cities even, where you can see marks of wholesale industrial decline. And so Momentum is located between two towns, Waterford and Mechanicville, both of which, if you drive through them, you can see signs of, you know, of decline, essentially, economically. And Momentum, you know, and I would talk to people on the picket line, and they would tell me about how, you know, their families and their communities, so many of them had worked at this plant that had closed and that plant that had closed. And it became clear to me over time by talking to these people who are my neighbors that this is basically one of the last kind of working factories left that provides, quote unquote, good jobs. And what I mean by that is jobs with benefits, jobs where theoretically one person can work in a family and not, you know, be wealthy, but at least, you know, like a solid middle class job. You know, blue collar jobs that also give people like the chance at the so-called American dream. Right. And so, you know, it didn't take that much talking. I mean, it took some talking for me to these, people. But then I was like, oh, well, you know, so part of what I did was I was just listening to them, and they would tell me about their feeling, you know, completely abandoned by the left, and I would say, and the right as well. I mean, these are people who just felt totally disenchanted with party politics. And they felt that Trump was honestly the only person who was speaking to them after Bernie dropped out, basically. So many of these people were Bernie supporters who went to Trump. And I think that that's a really important thing to note.
Yeah, and of course the sort of myth of the white working class and the sort of blue-collar male worker. When we look at your film, you see that's not true, right? You see workers who are not white. You see workers who are women. You had a really kind of sort of touching conversation with this one woman who works there who said that, you know, if Trump signs a national right to work bill, she'll definitely regret her vote.
You know, one of the things that that has already sort of bothered me and troubled me a little bit in seeing how some people have reacted to the film since it was released yesterday is people making kind of knee-jerk statements about the white working class. Mostly those are people who think of themselves as liberal, who are, you know, rabid anti-Trumpers, who are essentially saying, you know, I'm sick of hearing this story about the aggrieved white working class. These people are idiots, et cetera, and, you know, thanks for screwing us over or something like this. And, you know, the first thing that I would say to that is, first of all, this is not a universal. Like, these people are not all white. And they're not, like you said, they're not all male. And there is a tremendous, you know, there's, I mean, I would say this area is largely white, but there are a lot of people of color that I talked to for the film. And, you know, and I think that these sort of bumper sticker narratives are things that people have been clinging to sort of explain very complicated and much, like, longer-running issues around the growth of economic inequality, the erosion of union power in this country, et cetera. Anyway, I just want to sort of say that, you know, this is And this is a film that really tries to challenge those kind of monolithic understandings of not just what happened, but what is happening to working people in this country. That includes all working people of all ethnicities, mm-hmm. all genders, et cetera.
Yeah, and it was sort of because of the way that the voices were layered under it, you didn't necessarily know who you're hearing talk. And it was the same person on the screen.
Yeah, and that was a very deliberate thing. You know, this is a collective piece in a way. You know, I believe that the main character of the film is the union, and that's very deliberate. It's a film that is trying to, you know, a lot of documentaries tend to try and tell stories through one or two or three characters. To me, it seemed more important to think about what does it mean that all of these people are working together, right? It's just a sort of fundamental principle. I think there's a deep, deep, deep cynicism in the United States about unions, and yet the principle of a union still stands, right? It's still the sort of very basic idea that one person is not going to be able to negotiate anything with their employer or with anyone in power. But collectively, that actually becomes possible. So in that sense, that's what the film is trying to essentially remind us of. You know, it seems to be something that's been completely undermined in the United States, this idea of collective action. And yet it seems to be the only thing that people are, the only thing that we have as a resource in a sense right now is our collective voice.
Yeah. So what did you learn from doing this film about sort of talking to people who may have voted for Trump you know, if you have advice for people who are trying to bridge those gaps right now?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that when I began this film, I mean, after the election, I said to my husband, who is an organizer, the last thing I want to do is talk to a Trump voter. And I was saying that as a woman, I was saying that as a woman of color, I was saying that as somebody who just literally just felt like, I can't do it. That's just a conversation I can't have. It was too painful. It was too triggering. And it honestly caught me by surprise, the conversation, because like I said, I sort of naively assumed that these union people didn't vote for Trump. And I was very wrong about that. And so I found myself in that conversation. And one of the things that I found myself having to do was to, first of all, stop and listen. You know, for me, how do I say this? As somebody who, I cared so much about what these strikers were up to, I was inclined to try and understand where they were coming from. And that really helped me to sort of stop imposing my point of view and listen to them. And as a documentary filmmaker, it really wasn't my place to try and change their minds. And that actually really helped. Because I think that, you know, very often, I think that that's one of the most powerful tools that an organizer and an activist or anybody who's trying to sort of actually move the needle is the first thing people need to do is to listen to the person that they're talking to. And actually respect them. I hear a lot of people, you know, talking about Trump voters and, you know, there's that caricatured, Trump voter who's usually, you know, a kind of a dude with his shirt off with a Make America Great Again hat on who, you know, is sort of spouting, racist, and idiotic things, right? I don't think that the vast majority of people who voted for Trump actually correspond to that stereotype. So I think that the first thing that people need to actually do is be willing to maybe set aside some of their resentments for a second and just listen to people. And the other thing that I think is really important here, so, you know, we have this caricature of the Trump voter, and, you know, I think that that unfortunately, I think people on the left are just as guilty of simplistic thinking as people on the right sometimes.
Yeah.
And I don't think that serves us. And I think that, you know, I think that we would get a lot further in trying to fight Trump if we actually tried to understand why, how people got to the thinking that they have. So for example, one of the things that the Trump administration has already supported and Republicans have already introduced is national right to work legislation. When I would talk to workers on the picket line about this, and I would, you know, bring this up as saying, you know, Trump supports right to work, many of them didn't know what right to work was. And when I explained it to them, they said, really, that's what right to work is? Oh, I don't support that. That's terrible, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't that they were stupid. It was that they didn't know. And to me, the question becomes, well, how do we combat the lack of information? Because to me, it's more about the fact that nobody's talking to many of these people. You know, I think that's the work of grassroots organizing and advocacy. And to me, it was like, I felt that these people felt like nobody cared about them. And so I think that that's symptomatic, not of a voter's stupidity, but it's symptomatic of a failure on the part of those people who were supposed to be trying to inform and educate and get people to vote their way.
So how can people keep up with you, and how can they see the film?
So the film has been distributed on Fusion, but also through Field of Vision. The film is a partnership. It's part of a series called Our 100 Days, which was commissioned by Field of Vision and Firelight Media. It's a partnership. So it's you know, and I think all the films are really important because they chronicle a different aspect of a threat to ordinary Americans under the Trump administration. So this is the second in that series. And those are releasing every Thursday on Fusion. But this film is online, on both on Fusion but also on Field of Vision's website. And then also, I have a production company. I can include my website if you want. It's Black Crackle Film. I made a feature film that came out last year that's actually going to be broadcast on public television this summer about my gay uncle who died of AIDS. Very different story. But yeah, I think probably through my website they can find out more about all of that.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.